In view of the detailed opinions in Williams 1, it would be supererogation to track the arguments in all of their intricacy. On the basis of an extensive reexamination of the question, we conclude that the district court erred, but Section 241 must be read as it is written, to reach conspiracies to injure any citizen in the free exercise or enjoyment of any right or privilege secured to him by the Constitution or laws of the United States. That this language includes rights or privileges protected by the 14th Amendment, that whatever the ultimate coverage of the section may be, it extends to conspiracies otherwise within the scope of the section participated in by officials alone or in collaboration with private persons, and that the indictment in number 59 properly charges such a conspiracy in violation of Section 241. We shall confine ourselves to a review of the major considerations which induce our conclusion. There is no doubt that the indictment in number 59 sets forth a conspiracy within the ambit of the 14th Amendment. Like the indictment in number 60, it alleges that the defendant acted under color of law and that the conspiracy included action by the state through its law enforcement officers to punish the alleged victims without due process of law, in violation of the 14th Amendment's direct admonition to the states. 1. The indictment specifically alleges that the sheriff, deputy sheriff, and the patrolman participated in the conspiracy, that it was part of the plan and purpose of the conspiracy that Deputy Sheriff Price, while having the three victims in his custody in the Neshoba County Jail, would release them from custody at such time that he and the others of the defendants could and would intercept the three victims and threaten, assault, shoot, and kill them. This is an allegation of state action which, beyond dispute, brings the conspiracy within the ambit of the 14th Amendment. It is an allegation of official state participation in murder, accomplished by and through its officers with the participation of others. It is an allegation that the state, without the semblance of due process of laws required of it by the 14th Amendment, used its sovereign power and office to release the victims from jail so that they were not charged and tried as required by law, but instead could be intercepted and killed. If the 14th Amendment forbids denial of counsel, it clearly denounces denial of any trial at all. And we have consistently held the 14th Amendment protects the individual against state action, not against wrongs done by individuals. In the present case, the participation by law enforcement officers as alleged in the indictment is clearly state action, as we have discussed, and it is therefore within the scope of the 14th Amendment. 2. The argument, however, of Mr. Justice Frankfurter's opinion in Williams 1, upon which the district court rests its decision, cuts beneath this. It does not deny that the accused conduct is within the scope of the 14th Amendment, but it contends that in enacting Section 241, the Congress intended to include only the rights and privileges conferred on the citizen by reason of the substantive powers of the federal government, that is, by reason of federal power operating directly upon the citizen and not merely by means of prohibitions of state action. As the Court of Appeal for the Fifth Circuit in Williams 1, relied upon in the opinion below, put it, the Congress had in mind the federal rights and privileges which appertain to citizens as such and not the general rights extended to all persons by the 14th Amendment. We do not agree. The language of Section 241 is plain and unlimited. As we have discussed, its language embraces all of the rights and privileges secured to citizens by all of the Constitution and all of the laws of the United States. There is no indication from the language that the sweep of the section is confined to rights that are conferred by or flow from the federal government, as distinguished from those secured or confirmed or guaranteed by the Constitution. We agree with the observation of Mr. Justice Holmes in the United States versus Mosley, that the source of this section in the doings of the Ku Klux Klan and the like is obvious, and acts of violence obviously were in the mind of Congress. Naturally, Congress put forth all its powers. This section dealt with federal rights and with all federal rights, and protected them in the lump. It should not be construed so as to deprive citizens of the United States of the general protection which on its face Section 19, now Section 241, most reasonably affords. We believe, with Mr. Justice Holmes, that the history of the events from which Section 241 emerged illuminates the purpose and means of the statute with an unmistakable light. We think that history leaves no doubt that if we are to give Section 241 the scope that its origins dictate, we must accord it a sweep as broad as its language. We are not at liberty to seek ingenious analytical instruments for excluding from its general language the due process clause of the 14th Amendment, particularly since the violent denial of legal process was one of the reasons motivating enactment of the section. Section 241 was enacted as part of what came to be known as the Enforcement Act of 1870. The act was passed on May 31, 1870, only a few months after ratification of the 15th Amendment. In addition to the new Section 241, it included a reenactment of a provision of the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which is now Section 242. The intended breadth of Section 241 is emphasized by contrast with the narrowness of Section 242 as it then was. Section 242 forbade the deprivation under color of any law of any rights secured or protected by this act. The rights protected by the act were narrow and specific: to make and enforce contracts, to sue, be parties, give evidence, and to the full and equal benefit of all laws and proceedings for the security of person and property as is enjoyed by white citizens, and to be subject to like punishment, pains, penalties, taxes, licenses, and exactions of every kind, and none other. Between 1866 and 1870, there was much agitated criticism in the Congress and in the nation because of the continued denial of rights to Negroes, sometimes accompanied by violent assaults. In response to the demands for more stringent legislation, Congress enacted the Enforcement Act of 1870. Congress had before it and reenacted Section 242, which was explicitly limited, as we have described. At the same time, it included Section 241 in the Act, using broad language to cover not just the rights enumerated in Section 242, but all rights and privileges under the Constitution and laws of the United States. It was not until the statutory revision of 1874 that the specific enumeration of protected rights was eliminated from Section 242. The section was then broadened to include as wide a range of rights as Section 241 already did: any rights, privileges, or immunities secured or protected by the Constitution and laws of the United States. The substantial change thus effected was made with the customary stout assertions of the codifiers that they had merely clarified and reorganized without changing substance. Section 241 was left essentially unchanged, and neither in the 1874 revision nor in any subsequent reenactment has there been the slightest indication of a congressional intent to narrow or limit the original broad scope of Section 241. It's clear, therefore, that Section 241, from original enactment through subsequent codifications, was intended to deal, as Mr. Justice Holmes put it, with conspiracies to interfere with federal rights and with all federal rights. We find no basis whatsoever for a judgment of Solomon which would give to the statute less than its words command. The purpose and scope of the 1866 and 1870 enactments must be viewed against the events and passions of the time. The Civil War had ended in April 1865. Relations between Negroes and whites were increasingly turbulent. Congress had taken control of the entire governmental process in former Confederate states. It had declared the governments in 10 unreconstructed states to be illegal and had set up federal military administrations in their place. Congress refused to seat representatives from these states until they had adopted constitutions guaranteeing Negro suffrage and had ratified the 14th Amendment. Constitutional conventions were called in 1868. 6 of the 10 states fulfilled Congress's requirements in 1868, the other 4 by 1870. For a few years, radical Republicans dominated the governments of the southern states, and Negroes played a substantial political role. But countermeasures were swift and violent. The Ku Klux Klan was organized by southern whites in 1866, and a similar organization appeared with the romantic title of the Knights of the White Camellia. In 1868, a wave of murders and assaults was launched, including assassinations designed to keep Negroes from the polls. The states themselves were helpless, despite resort by some of them to extreme measures such as making it legal to hunt down and shoot any disguised man. Within the Congress, pressures mounted in the period between the end of the war and 1870 for drastic measures. A few months after the ratification of the 13th Amendment on December 6, 1865, Congress on April 9, 1866, enacted the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which, as we have described, included Section 242 in its originally narrow form. On June 13, 1866, the 14th Amendment was proposed, and it was ratified in July 1868. In February 1869, the 15th Amendment was proposed, and it was ratified in February 1870. On May 31, 1870, the Enforcement Act of 1870 was enacted. In this context, it is hardly conceivable that Congress intended Section 241 to apply only to a narrow and relatively unimportant category of rights. We cannot doubt that the purpose and effect of Section 241 was to reach assaults upon rights under the entire Constitution, including the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, and not merely under part of it. This is fully attested by the only statement explanatory of Section 241 in the recorded congressional proceedings relative to its enactment. We refer to the speech of Senator Poole of North Carolina, who introduced the provisions as an amendment to the Enforcement Act of 1870. The senator's remarks are printed in full in the appendix to this opinion. He urged that the section was needed in order to punish invasions of the newly adopted 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution. He acknowledged that the states as such were beyond the reach of the punitive process and that the legislation must therefore operate upon individuals. He made it clear that it matters not whether those individuals be officers or whether they are acting upon their own responsibility. We find no evidence whatsoever that Senator Poole intended that Section 241 should not cover violations of 14th Amendment rights or that it should not include state action or actions by state officials. We conclude, therefore, that it is incumbent upon us to read Section 241 with full credit to its language. Nothing in the prior decisions of this court or of other courts which have considered the matter stands in the way of that conclusion. The present application of the statutes at issue does not raise fundamental questions of federal-state relationships. We are here concerned with allegations which squarely and indisputably involves state action in direct violation of the mandate of the 14th Amendment, that no state shall deprive any person of life or liberty without due process of law. This is a direct, traditional concern of the federal government. It is an area in which the federal interest has existed for at least a century, and in which federal participation has intensified as part of a renewed emphasis upon civil rights. Even as recently as 1951, when Williams I was decided, the federal role in the establishment and vindication of fundamental rights, such as the freedom to travel, non-discriminatory access to public areas, and non-discriminatory educational facilities, was neither as pervasive nor as intense as it is today. Today, a decision interpreting a federal law in accordance with its historical design to punish denials by state action of constitutional rights of the person can hardly be regarded as adversely affecting the wise adjustment between state responsibility and national control. In any event, the problem, being statutory and not constitutional, is ultimately, as it was in the beginning, susceptible of congressional disposition. Reversed and remanded.